Welcome back to Seeds of Tomorrow, the next chapter. I'm Alessio De Laurentiis, and today we're exploring a story that sits right at the crossroad of research, innovation, and fruit breeding. It's one of the most intriguing scientific papers we've come across recently. I'm not alone in studio today, and joined by my colleague Juan Antonio Vives Valles, currently on secondment to the CBVO from the University of the Balearic Island, where he works on the legal dimensions of agricultural innovation and plant variety rights. Juan will be with us throughout the episode to help unpack some of the key points and bring in a CBVO perspective where it's useful. Today we are pleased to welcome Dr. Anna Wunsch and Dr. Afif Hedley from CITA, the Agri-Food Research and Technology Center in Aragon, and from EAD XIC, the Estación Experimental de Aula Dei, part of the Spanish National Research Council. Anna, Afif, welcome to Seeds of Tomorrow.
Thank you for having us.
We read your recent paper in Frontiers in Plant Science about what you call the ever-growing sweet cherry, and we thought we need to talk about this. So, first of all, congratulations, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
From your experience on the ground, what would you say are the biggest challenges for fruit production in region today? What keeps growing awake at night?
Well, today there is several challenges in fruit production in Spain. That is where we work mainly, but I think some of them are global. And one of them is adaptation. That's what we're working in this dormancy area of research. Mm-hmm. Adaptation mainly to climate change and adaptation to other growing areas that are not traditional production areas. That's expanding the areas of cultivation so the production can be increased to warmer areas or maybe even cooler areas. But there's other challenges like transport, consumer acceptance, mainly the development of cultivars that can give a response to these challenges. Mm-hmm. Adaptation, transport, commercialization, and maybe some diseases, I think, are common challenges.
Thank you. Now, let's jump into the paper, because the title alone really catches attention, the ever-growing sweet cherry. For people who are hearing this for the first time, when you say ever-growing, what does that actually mean? What is this cherry tree doing differently?
So ever-growing means that the trees doesn't enter into dormancy in winter, which is common for many temperate fruit trees. Mm-hmm. When the day is shortening and then the temperature is going down, the trees, they lose their leaves and then they enter into dormancy until environmental conditions are better again at the beginning of the spring when they go out of dormancy. So basically, ever-growing means that this plant material doesn't follow that that growth and dormancy relationship. So it's basically, I mean, there can be a confusion. People can understand it like it's a variety that is lacking dormancy, but in the end, exactly, at least from the molecular level, mm-hmm. It's a material that has an altered growth dormancy cycle. So the trees is perceiving environmental cues, and with those cues, it decides to enter the dormancy. So in this plant material, that perception is failing.
Okay.
If may I step in, may I ask you why this direction, precisely in terms of research? I mean, why this ever-growing tree? Technical problems could these solve in practice in the case of sweet cherry trees?
Yeah, we actually we were researching dormancy and adaptation to cold. Like if a challenge is to adapt to lower temperatures, we have to develop cultivars that can be that need a less amount of cold, chilling units or chilling hours. That's what we call. So we were researching on. We were working on plant materials from Spain that are original from the Mediterranean area. From this area, is this region has very low chilling in the winter. And so there's local plant materials that have very low chilling requirements. So we are using these plant materials to breed other plant materials, elite cultivars with low chilling requirements. And we are also investigating this area dormancy and the low chilling, looking at the genes that regulate this this trait in this plant material and comparing it with materials with high chilling requirements. But while doing this and while developing these materials, we were doing some crosses with low chilling plants, and after doing a self-pollination population, which is not common in sweet cherry because it's highly self-compatible, but we can do it. We found this phenotype. So it was
Sorry to jump in, but for our listeners, what is phenotype?
Ah, phenotype. Okay, phenotype is, well, we can say phenotype is the what you see, what you observe, what you can measure, and this is determined by the genotype, by the genes. So when we see this phenotype, that means that when we go in the field and on the plants and we saw this plant that is growing differently to the rest, we thought it was something important, interesting, because it's not found in sweet cherry. And that's why we focus then, and going back to your question, because I went around, that's why we focus in researching the evergreen or ever-growing plant material. It's because we have it. We have it, so we see it's an interesting tool to research dormancy.
From another perspective, if we take, for example, the case of sweet cherry, it's a tree that is cultivated in Northern Europe. In Germany, you have a lot of cherry, in Switzerland. And it's a tree that requires a lot of cold in winter to flower properly in the spring. But also we have cherry in Spain, but Spain is the limit of its cultivation to the south because cherry needs cold. In Spain, there is not enough cold. So there are varieties that are adapted to less cold, and they are cultivated in Spain. But if you go down to northern Africa, you just have some a little bit in Tunisia and Morocco. So basically, now with the climate change, you have less cold, and we need varieties that have much less necessity of cold, even in France, for example. And but we don't know how the molecular biology of the necessity of cold, how it's controlled. So we don't have the tools to breed for trees that have much less cold necessity than. So that's the importance of the subject. We need to know what's happening, how is regulated the necessity of cold in winter, and with that we can breed the new varieties.
So I guess that's why you raised the point in your paper that's, well, research and breeding, not just for climate change, but even for global warming, isn't it? I mean, we are trying to solve problems of this warming, particularly in these Mediterranean regions, isn't it?
Yes, we are. It's a global objective to look for cultivars with less chilling requirements. Many research groups are working in this direction, but it's a very complex process. And so what we add with this plant material is another approach, a new approach to this research, because we have plant material that can help us understand what is happening using plant material that doesn't go into dormancy.
And speaking of this plant material, could you walk us through the experimental design that you used in simple terms and how you obtained this ever-growing cherry, sweet cherry?
Well, as I said, we were doing crosses, generating plant materials of low chilling requirements. And specifically what we did is we did a population of self-pollination. That means usually for genetic studies, we do crosses with plants and we study the progeny. So we see how the characters are different in the different progeny, like the different seedlings. And in this case, this population, it has a high level of inbreeding because it's self-fertilization. And so there is several different and unique phenotypes that we can see in this population. It has that is what is called inbreeding depression. And we found this this phenotype, as I said before, that we thought it was interesting. And that was the process of obtaining it, more or less. We now have a collection of different unique phenotypes that we obtain through this process by self-pollination, by increasing the homozygosity of a really heterozygous species. No, maybe Afif, you want to complete my explanation.
No, I mean self-pollination is a very interesting methodology because it brings up the inbreeding depression, which is a lot of sterility, a lot of things, which from a biotechnological point of view and from a breeding point of view can be very interesting. So normally you don't breed for inbreeding depression, but you use it to find the mutants that you can use them later on in breeding processes. For example, in many hybrids, you look for male sterility, which is an attractive character. And with this population that Anna generated, so basically we have a lot of material we still didn't characterize, and they have very interesting biotechnological characters.
Yeah, in fact, you literally refer to inbreeding depression as a cause of sweet cherry evergreening trait. And also you mentioned the polygenic nature of this, the potential polygenic nature of this trait. Could you tell us how do you think these two considerations affect future research and breeding, particularly breeding?
The point of mutations. So basically, it's very difficult to think that this plant material, maybe it's due to a single mutation, let's say, that arises by inbreeding and you have it in homozygous. We would wish that it could be like that, but we are dealing with the character that is dormancy, that is a regulatory process that is dependent on perception of temperature, of photoperiod, and then a lot of genes are have an intervention on this character. And basically here, we can have some hypotheses. Maybe there are some few genes that are in homozygosis, which they were brought up together in this self-pollination, and that could explain the phenotype. But we are in the beginning of this, so it can be a single gene, but it's more likely that it's a polygenic character that arose from the combination of several recessive mutations.
So the molecular mechanism is quite elusive, isn't it? I mean, it's difficult to find, or as you said, you are just at the first stage of the process. But could you please explain to our listeners about the precise technique you used, about embryo rescue?
Well, the embryo rescue is just a technique we use to germinate the plants from this population. Embryo rescue means that when we have the seeds of the tree that we want to germinate, but these fruits mature very quickly, and so the embryo is sometimes immature. What we do is we, instead of sowing the seeds, we embryo rescue means we open the fruit, we open the seeds, and we take the embryo outside and we cultivate it in vitro, in growing media. That way we facilitate the germination of these seeds. It's just a way to help germination. But it is a quite a common technique in breeding of fruit trees or breeding of plant materials on and other biotechnological approaches on fruit trees or other species.
Back to me then. You used Zwitchery cristobalina as your starting point in research already back in 2008-9-ish. So why cristobalina? Yes. What made it the right variety to start with?
Okay, as I said before, cristobalina is one of the cultivars I was telling you that is original from Spain, mm-hmm. and has several very interesting traits for breeding. One of them is that it is self-compatible, which is very rare to find in nature in sweet cherry. Sweet cherry has a very strict self-incompatibility system. So this cultivar can self-pollinate itself, which other cultivars cannot. So this is a trait very important for production, so because it avoids the need to use pollinizers, pollinizer cultivars in the orchards. Another trait of interest in this cultivar is this low chilling requirements. And also it has a very early maturing fruit. It matures before any other fruits, any other cultivars that are grown today. This is because it has a very short fruit development time. So in sweet cherry, having an early maturity is very important for the price of the fruit, because the first cherries in the markets reach very high prices. So for these several characters, cristobalina is a cultivar that is of interest for breeding. But what happens is, since it is a local cultivar, the fruit is not very big. It matures very early, but it's not very big or doesn't have all the characters that the market requires today. So we can use it for breeding, and that's what we are doing, trying to introduce these traits of interest in elite germplasm. So that's why we chose it in the first place, and it ended being very interesting for these other traits for dormancy now, since we found this ever-growing progeny.
Okay, so if I understood well, your variety, even or your sweet cherry tree, even if breakthrough, must be further developed in order to get commercial varieties. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Right now, we are using it as a tool to research dormancy, but we are not sure it can be used for production at this time. It is a very powerful tool to understand the mechanisms of dormancy. And now we have seen also that it can regenerate very well in vitro. So it may be useful also to as a tool for developing gene editing, studying gene function through gene editing. But we are not sure it can go into production at this time.
So fitting perfectly well with the title of your paper, An Ever-Growing Sweet Cherry for Research and Breeding, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Yes, not for production yet.
In the paper, you mentioned that there are several unrelated species, particularly peach, hazelnut, and pomegranate, in which the evergreening trait has been also developed. Do you know of any commercial varieties, or at least varieties which are in the pipeline for those or other species?
I don't know if they used the ever-growing peach in breeding. It was discovered in Mexico in the 70s, and it was taken to the U.S. It's in some germplasm in the U.S. They studied it. And by the way, it was the peach overgrowing where the damn genes were discovered. And that's they are at the heart of dormancy. And that's why we also focused on those genes, because it's another plant material that has the same phenotype. And I think there are, not using this material, but in Mexico and in some Latin American countries where they try to have multiple production per year. Because if you don't, if the tree has doesn't have dormancy, it has a couple of flowers in a year, which is very interesting from a commercial point of view. But using these materials for breeding, I'm not aware of.
Professor, you just mentioned several countries that are outside the EU, and well, we as CPVO, we cater for IP protection in new plant varieties within the EU. CETA has a long history of applying for plant variety rights, as it is. Down the road, not now because it's not ready yet, but if you see the potential again in several years, when would you start thinking this new variety that we are developing would need protection? What would be the tipping point for you?
Well, we are now evaluating how its performance, whether we are not sure how it's gonna be, if it's gonna develop fruit. Because still in the tree is still in its juvenility period, because sweet cherry trees have a long juvenility until their first flower. So we are not sure how it's going to perform. And once we see if it has a potential for breeding, or we can develop other varieties from here, from it, I think for sure we'll think about protecting it, of course. Yes.
Yeah, in connection to this, it brings to me the publication versus secrecy dilemma. So I think publication is good for you and good, of course, good for research. But it's just an idea or a feeling that maybe could also make you lose some competitive advantage in the market. How do you manage that dilemma in CETA? Because you have the two lines, so research and also breeding. So how do you think you manage this, so to say, conflict?
From my point of view, I think I thought about this, we thought about this, but I think it's better to put it on the scientific community, to let the people know what we are doing and what we got. And we were very clear about how we obtain it too, so anybody else could do something similar and obtain similar plant materials. And I think it's good for we can advance in knowledge, and if we share knowledge, we can all walk forward and go faster. But we have the material. I think we already have it some years ago, so we have an advantage over other people that are starts now. But we are open also to collaborations. We are a research center, and we can collaborate with other groups or people, and I think we can get better results if we can collaborate and aim to reach for more in putting together different techniques or different experiences and so on.
So you believe in cooperation, in a win-win situation, I think. Yes, I was raising this question because your paper is an excellent manual on how to replicate your experiment, as it should be, by the way, but it struck us.
And speaking of researchers and the manual you just published, anything we should know about your next research? Anything that's exciting to you right now in other fields? If we zoom out a bit from the ever-growing cherry, is there anything else you are working on right now? Can you tell us a bit more? Can you?
We're working many things. I mean, I can tell you a few things. I'm sure Afif can tell you a few other things we are working on. We develop a wide research in sweet cherry. So, for example, we are going to publish very interesting work on fruit development. And we also looking into, as we said, into these populations of self-pollination and other unique phenotypes as sterile phenotypes. Afif can tell you a bit more about them. But we also, of course, we are moving forward with the research of the genes regulating dormancy, not only with this material, but with other plant materials too.
If you'd like to...
Yes, I mean, from the point of view of the evergrowing, as I said, its obtention, it doesn't give us answers, but it allows us to make the right questions. So we have a very valuable plant material to understand the molecular biology of how plants stop their growing and how they resume it. And it's really highly useful on this. That's why Anna, when she talked about cooperation, and we are open to cooperation with other groups, because we think that the scientific part or the scientific utility of this plant material is huge. So that's the most important thing. So basically, we are supervising a PhD to dive deep on the molecular biology of this character. Also, Anna, we are attempting as well, as she said before, the transformation, because it regenerates very well. And as you know, there is a bottleneck in fruit trees for doing transformation or gene editing, because there is a problem about regenerating cells or regenerating individuals in vitro. And this plant material, it looks like it regenerates very well. So we are hopeful there that we can contribute scientifically even in providing material for this. Apart from that, I mean, the whole population that Anna generated of inbreeding depression, I mean, for me, I worked a lot on reproduction in plants. And there are several points where you can use them for biotechnology and for many things. So we have like more than 180 individuals. Each one has a different type of mutation. And we try to make a global characterization of them and then pick the best ones. So if we can find some applied objectives there. Apart from that, of course, we have different other lines of research, mainly on dormancy and the effect of environmental stress on reproduction, on food development, on quality. So there are many, many research lines.
In connection to what you were telling, I think your paper is an excellent example of basic research, applied research, and also pre-breeding efforts. Where do you think that resources should be placed in order to achieve breakthroughs?
Okay, I think this is just a personal opinion. I think basic research is very important. Applied research, of course, too. I mean, they are all important. But lately, I perceive more emphasis on applied research and innovation and more funding in this area. And I think basic research should still be very important, because without the basic research, we are not going to move forward.
We are near the end of the time we were together today. And finally, for young researchers, listen to this, especially those who want to work in fruit breeding, genetics, or innovation. What advice would you give them? What skills or mindset matter most if they want to succeed in this field?
I mean, the advice is that to join as many skills as you can. Basically, nowadays, for a successful scientist in our field, you need to be a bioinformatician, you need to be a molecular biologist, you need to be a breeder. You need a lot of things. So either you build a lot of skills personally, or you integrate yourself within a multi-skilled group, let's say. So it's important to have a multidisciplinary work, multidisciplinary research with different approximation from basic to applied. And as Anna said, all approximation are very important. Fundings are for more applied research and for pre-breeding. But also, in this particular subject of dormancy, also basic research is highly needed to understand this character.
Yes, I agree with Hafif totally. And I also add that you need to like plants a lot if you're in the this horticultural area. That's what like moved me, for example, at first place. But then it is very diverse work, as Afif said. You have a lot of different, you have field work, you have lab work, you have all the scientific work. And also, as Afif said, it's very important lately, all the bioinformatics work. It's what we are, it's most needed, I think, one of the most needed things. Although the basic and traditional techniques are also needed, the bioinformatics people is highly needed, but not only informatics, you know, that they know the field, they know the biological aspect and applications. And I think maybe sometimes there is a lack of this type of people, and they are very, very highly demanded. So I think people that specializes in this area has a secure career, yeah.
Thank you.
I wanted to add to what Afif said too, that another important trait or character for a researcher is that sometimes is not so talked about is creativity that I mentioned before, because you have to be very creative to design experiments, to come up with ideas of things to be researched and to focus your research. So that's something what you can develop also with work, but sometimes you don't think about it, but it's important. Not only creative people can be good for art or other things, but for science I think it's very important too.
And also having a good network and collaborate with other teams, because when you stumble upon something that is unexpected, the good thing about a large network is that someone somewhere is an expert in what you just found and you have just to reach out for them.
Yes, totally. In our case, Afif is an expert in adaptation to climate change and in reproductive biology, and I'm more focused on breeding and genetics and of sweet cherry. And so, when we join together to develop more this plant material and to research it, it's a good combination because we both can add different knowledge and different experience that make it more successful.
Mm-hmm. I think your paper is also an excellent example of different approaches. So in 2008, you basically reached your results by chance. I think serendipity or chance played a big role there. But then in 2021, you pursued a standardized experiment, and you not just repeated the results, but even managed to do research on the molecular mechanism and the other many other things. So the question is, how do you think that chance and ad hoc or on purpose experiments play there in research nowadays?
I think it's very... It happens a lot. I think, as you said, in this case was a chance, but then we were working, of course, when it happened, and then we work more to do it again. I'm just too sad I didn't try it again earlier, didn't wait it so long. But yes, chance happens a lot. Many times when we are researching, we find things we didn't expect it. Most of the times, you don't find what you were looking for, but you get find other things and raise new questions, and you have to redirect what you were looking for. I think it happens a lot, and it's you have to be creative to adapt and find a way to find a application for new results and how to refocus your research.
But I still think that the chance, it can be also pursued. So basically, you need to have a capacity of observation and intuition. That's experience. That's capacity. So, and this is a very important trait in science. Like when you say in French, la bonne chance, c'est un style de vie. the chance it doesn't come alone. So you need to have a capacity to observe. There is a lot of new things happening around, and in science, it's a virtue to have a good observation and intuition, and it's a mixture of all of these things, I think, at the end.
So, Dr. Wunsch, Dr. Hedley, thank you so much for your time. And once again, congratulations on the work. It really is a remarkable piece of research, and we're grateful you shared the story with our audience. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and for appreciating our work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to follow Seeds of Tomorrow and stay tuned for the next conversations on plant breeding, research and innovation. Seeds of Tomorrow, a podcast by the Community Plant Variety Office, where innovation takes root.